This hour, we'll be hearing excerpts from the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on the proposition a democratically elected Hamas is still a terrorist organization. The live event took place at Asia Society in New York City on the evening of November 29, 2006. It was sponsored by the Rosenkrantz Foundation and was moderated by television journalist Judy Woodruff. Speaking in favor of the motion were Stephen Cook, the Douglas Dillon Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, John O'Sullivan, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and Daniel Ayalon, Israel's ambassador to the United States. Opposing the motion were Stanley Cohen, a lawyer who often represents Palestinian activists, Mahmoud Ould Mohammadou, associate director of the Harvard Program on Humanitarian Policy and Conflict Research, and Mark Perry, co-director of the UK and DC-based Conflicts Forum. Now, a few words about the format. Each debate consists of an 8-minute opening speech from each panelist, followed by a discussion of questions raised by the audience. The evening concludes with short summary statements from both sides. The audience was polled on the motion, a democratically elected Hamas is still a terrorist organization, before and after the event. The entry poll gauged the live audience as largely on the side of the proposers, voting 60% in favor and only 19% against. 21% were undecided. We'll begin by listening to excerpts of the opening speeches. Here's the proposer of the resolution, Stephen Cook.
Thank you very much for being here this evening. I'd like to thank, first of all, IQ2 and the Rosenkrantz Foundation. And looking out at the audience today, it's truly extraordinary what a diverse group we have, people in the audience who wouldn't normally sit together to discuss such difficult and often emotional issues. The subject of this evening's debate is, in one sense, rather puzzling. Despite electoral success, Hamas is still a terrorist organization. What is there really to debate here? What does participation in an election have to do with Hamas's profile as a terrorist organization? I'm quite sure that my colleagues on the other side of the debate will tell you that the Palestinian elections were the truest, freest, and fairest in the Arab world. That's an absolutely true statement. They're also going to tell you that the outcome reflected the will of the Palestinian people. That's an absolutely false statement. And three, they're going to tell you that Hamas provides critical social services to Palestinians in need. That is, my friends, totally irrelevant to tonight's subject. These arguments amount to little more than an analytical sleight of hand. An organization can participate in a free and fair election, it can provide social services, and be a terrorist organization. It is not an intellectual position to suggest that Hamas is no longer a terrorist organization. It's an ideological position. It's ideological, rather than an analytical conclusion based on the available evidence. Let's consider a few things. Hamas's very founding in the late 1980s was based on an imperative of violence. In the late 1980s, members of the Palestine branch of the Muslim Brotherhood grew concerned that another organization called Islamic Jihad was taking prestige and influence away from them because Islamic Jihad was engaged in violence. Their solution to this political problem was the establishment of Hamas. They would continue the Islamization of Palestinian society from below through the provision of social services in keeping with the historic mission of the Muslim Brotherhood. But they also established a military wing that was dedicated to terrorist acts against Israelis in an effort to burnish their nationalist image and outmaneuver Islamic Jihad. The founding covenant of Hamas, which has not changed, is explicit in its mission to liberate all of historic Palestine through a variety of tactics, including violence. My critics will say this is old news, but my question is, has Hamas really evolved? It still denies Israel's right to exist. None of its leaders have renounced the right to armed struggle. The only thing has changed is a tactical change. It has sought to harness the elections that the United States has pushed on the Palestinians to advance its agenda. And what is that agenda? The establishment of a Palestinian state in all of historic Palestine with Sharia, Islamic law, at its core. Well, what about a ceasefire? My critics will tell you there's been a ceasefire since 2003. Be careful about the words that people use when talking about a ceasefire. Hamas calls it a hudna. My colleague Mahmoud Mohamedou calls it tahdiya. Anyone who speaks Arabic should know that a hudna has a finite period of time. It's not much of a ceasefire anyway. Since the Israelis withdrew from the Gaza Strip, they've been victim of rocket assaults on their towns, the kidnapping of their soldiers, and threats to their major cities. Under the weight of available evidence, supporters of Hamas tend to shift their argument to focus on Israeli behavior. It is true. Israel has expropriated land and continues to illegally settle the West Bank. Israel has killed Palestinian civilians, though unlike Hamas, not intentionally. If the issue was Israel's contributed to an environment where extremist ideologies, alienation, and terrorism can thrive, there would be little to debate. But this is not the subject we're examining here this evening. Participation in elections. Hamas's participation in the Palestinian elections is analytically irrelevant whether it is a terrorist organization or not. For Hamas to no longer be considered a terrorist organization, it must change its charter, it must renounce its violence, and it must lay down its arms. At that point, and only at that point, can it be seen as a legitimate participant in the political arena. With that, I urge you to vote with the proposition that a democratically elected Hamas is and remains a terrorist organization. Thank you very much.
Against the proposition, Stanley L. Cohen.
I come from a different perspective. Interestingly enough, I've just returned from Damascus, where I happen to be meeting with the leadership of Hamas. And I bring that to your attention because when I said I was coming to a debate in New York City over whether you're a terrorist organization or not, the leadership said, "You Westerners, you spend all your time debating how many angels are in the head of a pin, and history marches on." And that's not to denigrate or to diminish the significance of this debate, this discussion tonight, but to keep in its perspective that while we debate, while we argue, while we disagree, there is death and destruction on the ground. And while my adversary trivializes the injury to Palestinians, I'd like to sort of begin by really honing in on what we're talking about tonight. Since the year 2000, 4,800 Palestinians, mostly civilians, killed, 839 children under 10, 755 women, 241 extrajudicial assassinations, 11,000 Palestinians, including 380 under the age of 16, and 240 women sitting in jails, most of whom who have never had a trial, have never seen a judge, and do not have counsel. 4,800 homes demolished, thousands of hectares of olive groves razed. In the last 5 months, while unfortunately Israel has lost 10 civilians, 557 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli Defense Forces. Now, collective punishment, that's not the exception. Attacks on the infrastructure, the disruption of water plants, unemployment, infant mortality rates, disease, malnutrition. These are not issues for abstract debate. These are harsh realities for Palestinians. Who did this? Hamas didn't do this. Israel did this. And it's not new. Think back to the British. The Stern Gang, Menachem Begin, a prime minister of Israel, a terrorist. The King David and Semiramis hotels blown up. The UN mediator assassinated by the Stern Gang. Ethnic cleansing with 800,000 Palestinians driven from their homes. So this is not some sort of esoteric debate with the West. This is reality, this is truth, and this is 60 years. An unbroken trail of terrorism, not at the hands of Hamas, but at the hands of Israel. I love the notion about how Israel, always unlike Hamas, accidentally kills. Of course, the apologies. Of course, Israel says, "Oops, we're sorry. We'll have an investigation," and on it goes. 321 condemnations by the United Nations General Assembly ignored. There is a double standard. And that's what's interesting, and I mean no disrespect to the debate tonight, As a trial attorney, sometimes I say to a witness, so when did you stop beating your wife? And the witness looks at you like, what are you talking about? And that's the problem with the debate. It starts out with a preconceived notion that Hamas is a terrorist organization. To much of the world, Hamas is not viewed as a terrorist organization, but rather a national liberation movement involved in low-intensity asymmetric warfare. To much of the world, Israel is viewed as a terrorist state. The problem is civilians are always caught in between. I don't apologize for any civilian getting killed anywhere, but I don't make light of it as if they're just fodder for the Israeli machine. There is a fine line between terrorist and freedom fighter, unfortunately, and it is who wins. Every person in the world dies to have a picture taken with Nelson Mandela, who stayed in jail an extra 8 years because he refused to renounce armed struggle. So we have to be careful about evolving notions of terrorism. Who is Hamas? Hamas is not just a military wing. They're doctors and lawyers and professors and scientists and academics who've given their life to try to reclaim what has been stolen from them. Now, you can trivialize the election, but most important, remember, Hamas is millions of people who voted, and many of them voted for Hamas. Now, what do we know that's happened since the election? Collective punishment, leaders kidnapped, an attempt to destabilize and topple a legitimate elected government, economic embargoes and strangulations, providing arms to the other side. Let us find a way to break out of this cycle, to break out of this abyss. The only group that can deliver is Hamas. And you know what? If they can't, they'll be voted out. And at the end of the day, it's time to end the embargo. It's time to empty the jails. But most of all, forget the labels and forget the rhetoric. For 60 years, it has not worked. Give the alternative a chance. Thank you.
We now continue with Intelligence Squared U.S. The next speaker in this debate is John O'Sullivan, speaking for the motion, a democratically elected Hamas is still a terrorist organization.
Madam Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen, I will begin by going straight to the topic, because anyone who deals with terrorism has to begin, and I was invited to do this by the last speaker, with its definition. I think he must also scotch the old canard that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. My own definition has the distinction of having been adopted by the Court of Appeals in Canada. If I may quote Mr. Justice Nadon quoting me in the case of Canada versus Majoub in October 2001, the court spoke as follows. A terrorist is a man who murders indiscriminately, distinguishing neither between civilian, innocent and guilty, nor soldier and civilian. He may employ terrorism, planting bombs in restaurants, hijacking planes, in a bad cause or a good one. He may be a Nazi terrorist or an anti-Nazi terrorist, a communist or an anti-communist, pro-Palestinian or pro-Israel. We may want to defeat his political cause or to see it triumph. For his methods, however, the terrorist is always to be condemned. Indeed, to describe him objectively is to condemn him, even if his cause is genuinely a fight for freedom with which we sympathize. Unquote, unquote. Now, we are asked today to consider whether organizations that use terrorist methods as described above should also be admitted into the arena of conventional politics, and in particular to the arena of conventional democratic politics. The motion cites Hamas. But Hamas is not the only organization that combines seeking power through elections with terrorism. Hezbollah does the same. So does the ETA-linked Batzuona party in the Basque region of Spain. So does the two-headed Sinn Féin IRA in Northern Ireland. Nor are these organizations shy about their deeds. They openly boast of employing terrorism, even if they sometimes quibble at the word. Sinn Féin, for example, has said clearly that it sought power through the Armalite rifle and the ballot box. These four parties I've mentioned have enjoyed varying degrees of success. But they all raise the same question. If a democratically elected group employs terrorist methods, should it be regarded as having read itself out of democratic politics, and should we refuse to deal with it? Ideally, I maintain that they should be read out of politics and that we should refuse to deal with them. Indeed, I would go further. When we deal with such bodies as if they are conventional parties, we are making murder respectable. We are, in fact, inciting people to murder. First, because we are saying that murder is no bar to participation in high politics. And when we treat with terrorist parties supported by small numbers of voters, as is true of the Basque Party and it used to be true of Sinn Féin, we are inciting murder a second time because we have admitted we are negotiating with them because they murder people and not for any other reason. When you incite murder, you get more murders. Inciting terrorism has similarly produced a spreading stain of terrorism since the hijackings of Dawson Field in 1970. Let me make a first qualification to this bold statement of principle. If the price of halting a murderous insurgency is to admit the former terrorists into democratic politics, that may sometimes be a price worth paying to save lives and establish a decent political order. But it is a price. The terrorists, moreover, must be former. They must have abandoned terrorism, finally, completely and publicly. They cannot be mysteriously linked to terrorists still, or leaving terrorism in a gradual way. They must be exclusively committed to democratic politics and willing to accept its verdicts, even when those verdicts are unfavourable to them. But the distinguished advocates tonight opposite are proposing something far more dramatic than easing former thugs out of terrorism and into official limousines. They suggest that we should treat as good faith Democrats those who are still engaged in organising suicide bombings and still planning rocket attacks. Their election, it seems, somehow validates their terror methods, or at least their terror methods do not invalidate their election.
And now, against the proposition, Mahmoud Ul Mohammadou.
Thank you very much, Ms. Woodruff. Let me add my voice to that of my colleagues to thank you and the organizers as well as the audience for this. It's a wonderful opportunity to have indeed intelligent debate. Let me also preface my remarks by saying that my comments tonight are mine alone and don't necessarily reflect the views of my program. Let me pick up the argument where my friend Stan left it, and it is that the inability to transcend the dominant misrepresentation of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands is increasingly becoming problematic for both intelligent debate and informed policymaking. It is a narrative that most people know to be problematic, if not faulty, yet it persists. Tonight's motion fits that pattern, and I invite you to reject it on grounds of inaccuracy and lack of intelligence, for that matter. Hamas is not a terrorist organization. Hamas was the radicalized military expression of a national liberation movement, which grew into a social movement. Hamas is no longer a terrorist organization. Hamas has moved to a political contest, which it has joined legitimately and has won fairly. More importantly, Hamas holds high levels of legitimacy among the majority of the people that it has been elected to represent and lead. Now, before developing these arguments, it is important to establish a set of facts. Yet there is a familiar discourse, an emotional discourse, about the plight of the Palestinians, which I will not rehearse here tonight. It is a classical discourse which, unfortunately, has been, in recent years, rendered part of the background noise of world politics, triggering almost a sort of Palestine fatigue. However, and in addition to the facts that Stanley has listed, it is the following facts that are crucial to the assessment of the situation and the proposed motion before us tonight. 39 years of occupation, 1.4 million people in Gaza alone in 360 square kilometers, 540 checkpoints in the West Bank alone, with a 40% increase in that number in the past year, settlements and buildings and land confiscation, the building of a separation wall, not a fence, a wall deemed illegal by the International Court of Justice, daily, near-daily military incursions with sporadic killing, essentially almost half a century of Palestinian dispossession, loss of life and freedom. Now, in that most urgent of context, a group that emerges as a resistance movement grows into a social network operating welfare centers and educational services and agrees to abide by the rules of democratic contest can certainly no longer be called terrorist. Now, Canadian definitions notwithstanding, it is important, and this is no mere matter of semantics, to remember that the word terrorist is actually quite problematic when it comes to occupied people. Yes, indeed, the saying, "Your terrorist is my freedom fighter," captures that inherent subjectivity quite well. And some names were mentioned. To those, we can add just this past century, Michael Collins and the IRA, and I will not even mention the Haganah and the Irgun and its Haq Shamir and others, Nelson Mandela and the ANC, and so on. All of these people have been called by their opponents terrorists, the French resistance fighting the Germans, the FLN fighting the French. Yet time and again, both these individuals and their movements led their groups to national leadership and oftentimes through elections. But the operative world of the motion is still. So is Hamas still a terrorist organization? Well, let us look at what Hamas has done in the past 10 months since their election. Even before that election, Hamas had decided on and implemented a unilateral ceasefire, which it observed for 15 months straight until the Israeli killing this past June of the seven-member Ghalia family. Hamas had made formal statements at the highest level of its multifaceted representation regarding a disposition to enter this long-term truce. Much is made of this concept of hudna. It is important to understand that, in fact, the phraseology used and the legal term is actually quite important in relation to an Islamist movement, which it perforce obligates them to, and indeed is a form of proto-recognition to begin with. Hamas has been part of discussions throughout the summer and the fall on a draft document for a program that would, quote, respect previous agreements in a manner that protects and safeguards the higher interests and the rights of the Palestinian people. Hamas had also proposed a coalition government back in March, which included Palestinian Christians and women, and has folded its executive force into the formal national police. What have Israel, the EU, and the United States done in the same time frame? Insisting on this threefold demand that Hamas recognizes Israel, forswears violence, and accepts previous Israeli-Palestinian agreements, they have decreed and implemented a crippling international embargo with a new humanitarian crisis by UN reckoning, a security crisis by security specialist reckoning, and indeed some sort of Iraqization of Palestine with the birth in mid-October of Al-Qaeda in Palestine, which sent its first tape, a novelty by Palestinian standards. But at this point, one is really prompted to think, what kind of international community is this that is so blind to the injustice that it rationalizes and the one that it perpetuates out of ill-conceived and impatient policies? But the argument I'm putting before you is not an emotional one. It is not an ideological one. It is actually a rational one. The obvious problem with the threefold demand is the disappearance of reciprocity. For the very same three demands could be put, but are not, to Israel. Israel has yet to recognize the existence of a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders. Israel has yet to stop its use of violence against occupied people, including women and children. And Israel has yet to implement the very agreements that it's made with Palestinian representatives. It is therefore contradictory to depict Hamas as still a terrorist organization while punishing Palestinians for their democratic choice. It should also be said that we're, in effect, asking Hamas to be held to agreements which we no longer trust. While everyone is saying that Oslo is dead and that we need new thinking and moving on, we are asking this newcomer to be held to these agreements which have faded or are certainly fading, and in effect holding them to our own liabilities and failures. Contradiction is also displayed through a reading of the facts. There is no internationally agreed definition of terrorism, which is already an evidence of that problem. However, by law, what qualifies an entity as terrorist is the indiscriminate targeting of civilians. So for the law to have any consistent currency, it has to be applied across the board and certainly not selectively.
One.
Which leads me to my last element. Hamas is an adolescent Hezbollah. And look at what Hezbollah has become next door, the strongest power in Lebanon and the first one to ever defeat Israel. So there's a sort of the assumption that Hamas can be extricated from that political reality is unrealistic. Ladies and gentlemen, given half a chance, Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh and his Hamas colleagues are Gerry Adamses in the making. Voting for this motion essentially means endorsing and supporting a unilateral, sterile understanding of this conflict. I invite you to exercise intelligence, display fairness, and vote against the motion. Thank you for your attention.
And for the proposition, Daniel Ayalon.
Good evening. Israel was attacked in 1967 practically by three countries around us, Jordan, Egypt, and Syria. The occupation, quote-unquote, as they call it, is this territory which was obtained by Israel as an act of self-defense. These three countries and others were trying to push us into the sea and actually destroy Israel, destroy the Jewish people who came back to their historic land, to their biblical land, to the place where they belong. Now, the war happened in 1967. Israel was created in 1948. From 1948 to 1967, 19 years, there was no occupation. West Bank belonged to Jordan. Gaza belonged to Egypt. Nobody talked about occupation then. Nobody talked about creating a Palestinian state. You know why? Because they wanted to create this Palestinian state right where Israel is now today, killing all the Jews. So, from 1967 on, against our will, we had to defend ourselves and obtain possession of these territories. But still, we always wanted peace. The proof, 1977, when we had a leader like Anwar Sadat of Egypt, and he signed a peace treaty with us, and he renounced terror and violence, and he recognized Israel. Israel withdrew entirely from the Sinai, having peace with Jordan now for more than 30 years, with Egypt for more than 30 years. 1995, Jordan, King Hussein, a great leader, wanted to make peace. We made peace. We withdrew from all the land that we occupied from Jordan, and there is a peace between Israel and Jordan. In 1993, Israel, believing that the Palestinians really had a change of heart and they would like to make peace with us, we signed the Oslo Accord. And the Oslo Accord was a very simple deal. Land for peace. Israel withdrawing from West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinians get a hold of themselves, stop the terror, and becoming a responsible party. 2000, Camp David, former Prime Minister Barak meeting with Arafat to try and make peace. Barak is offering to withdraw from the entire territories, but this was not accepted by Arafat. Now, people compare between Camp David 78 that succeeded and Arafat Camp David 2000. What was the difference? The difference was leadership. Sadat wanted to make peace. He prevailed over the advice of his advisors and signed the peace treaty. Arafat also, unfortunately, prevailed over the advice of his advisors, who said, sign the peace treaty because you will not get a better deal. And he was against it. Now, Hamas was against Arafat. They did not even believe in the negotiations. They are against, and they were against this Oslo. Why? Because they do not believe in Israel's right to exist. They do not believe in coexistence. They do not believe in peace. They do not believe even in a democracy, because they would like to have a one Islamist Palestinian country, a la Iran, Iran style, and under the Sharia, the law of Islam. So let's go back to the debate tonight. What is the definition of terror? Killing intentionally of innocent people. What does Hamas do? Killing only children and innocent people. This is what they do. Are they a terrorist organization? If this is the definition of terror, they definitely are a terror organization. Secondly, do they believe in coexistence? No, they deny Israel's right to exist. Now, people here are talking about we're elected democratically or not. This is beside the point. Just look into the Hamas, www.hamas.com, in their website, in the internet, and look into the Hamas charter. Now, there is also another issue here. Who is Hamas operated by? Are they really doing the will of the people? I don't think so. My esteemed colleague here on the other side, Stanley Cohen, said he just returned from Damascus, and he met Khaled Mashal. Where did he meet Khaled Mashal? in Damascus. Who is really operating Khaled Mashal? The Syrians and the Iranians. So they're not really representing Palestinian authentic interests. They are representing the interests of these crazy Islamists in Tehran and in Damascus. Now, there is this question whether they were democratically elected. Well, I would say a broad definition of democracy is, you know, doing the will of the people, but also observing the rule of law. And the rule of law does not permit gangs to be brandishing their guns and going with bullets into the ballots. There were elections held in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the former Yugoslavia. In all these elections, armed gangs were denied the right of voting and also of being elected.
Time is up.
Just vote for the motion.
Thank you very much.
I'm Robert Siegel with Intelligence Squared US, and we'll now rejoin the debate with moderator Judy Woodruff.
And the final opening argument is an argument against from Mark Perry.
The problem isn't that Hamas is a terrorist organization. The problem is that Hamas is a Muslim organization. That's what scares the hell out of us. And we ought to put it all out on the table and just say it. And how do we know that? Because the United States has dealt with terrorist organizations throughout its history, and so has Israel. How do I know that we deal with terrorist organizations? Because tomorrow, the President of the United States is meeting with a man by the name of Nouri al-Maliki. Who is he? Nouri al-Maliki is the head of the Dawah Party. Who's the Dawah Party? The Dawah Party opposed Saddam Hussein. When we supported Saddam Hussein, we put him on the terrorism list. When we changed sides, we took him off the terrorism list. That doesn't matter. They bombed the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait and killed three Americans. We're talking to him because it's in our interest to talk to him, terrorist or not. So what is the problem with Hamas? Well, if you listen to the media and if you listen to our political leaders, here's what they have to say. They don't have our values, our Judeo-Christian values. They do not have legitimacy. How do political parties and movements gain legitimacy? It's not conferred by Israel or the United States, it's conferred by the people. They won an election. Oh no, their critics say. They didn't win the election. Fatah lost it. They want to destroy Israel. So did the PLO. They have a charter that says they want to destroy Israel. So did the PLO. And yet we've had Hamas leaders that say the following. We have a charter that says, yes, we admit it, we want to destroy Israel. But the charter is not the Quran, and it can be changed. And under the right circumstances, if we can talk to our adversaries, we can and we will change it. The other argument that we say, we've heard it tonight, they provide social services. Those cynical people, how could they do that? You mean they're actually trying to serve their people, clear up corruption? Here's what they've done. They've penetrated the education and health ministries, cleaned them up. That's 40% of the total employment in the government of Palestine. They've thrown out the corrupt people. Don't we want good governance? Shouldn't we talk to people who want good governance, who stand for elections? They have killed innocent people. Brutally. Terribly. Like others have. They killed innocent people, and they cannot be absolved. But after long discussions with Hamas conducted by my organization, painful discussions, arguments about the killing of innocents, not moral arguments, practical, effective, political arguments, they stopped these suicide bombings through talk because they realized how ineffective they were, how they were losing support for what they feel is a legitimate cause. There hasn't been a Hamas-led suicide bombing in Israel since August of 2004. That's a fact. People can change. There are three conditions for Hamas being recognized as a legitimate political party: to renounce violence, to give up their arms, and to recognize Israel. We've been through this and through this with Hamas. We said, why don't you do this? And the best answer that I've had from a Hamas leader is as follows. If we do that, if we renounce violence, if we give up our arms, and if we recognize Israel, what's there to talk about? What do we talk to our enemies about? Do you think they're going to say, oh, welcome to the world of nations, fine, we'll withdraw to the 67 borders? Here's what we would like. We will recognize Israel. Khaled Meshaal has said this very straightforward in Damascus again and again and again and again. We understand and we recognize that the Israeli people, the Jewish people, have a narrative. It's an important narrative. We've listened to it for many, many years. We have legitimate grievances. If you will recognize our legitimate grievances and recognize our narrative as a people, we can begin to share a narrative. But until that point comes, when you stand up and say, we understand that you have grievances that have to be addressed, we're not going to recognize anybody. We're going to represent our people. Now, here's what's happening, I think, in the Middle East. There are, on the internet, calls for the assassination of the leaders of Hezbollah and Hamas by the leaders of Al-Qaeda. Why? Because Hamas and Hezbollah have accepted the Western colonial mandate to stand for elections and represent their people. Al-Qaeda thinks that's a trick. Hamas and Hezbollah don't. They answer to their people. We are lumping together the Girondins with the Jacobins. We are lumping together the true reformers in the Middle East, the ones who want to answer to their people, with the people who drove their airplanes into our buildings. It is so counterproductive. We are radicalizing the region. There are moderates in Islam. They're called Hamas, whether we like it or not. And it's time to open up to them. I thank you.
We now move to the question and answer period of the debate with a question from an audience member and the answer she got from Stephen Cook.
In the front, yes.
This is for the people who are for the motion. It seems that the U.S. wants democratically elected governments in the Middle East only if it's one that they like. Not just Hamas, but, for example, the reticence to have free and fair elections in Egypt out of concern that the Muslim Brotherhood would prevail. Isn't that a little bit hypocritical? And as a corollary to that, when these groups are actually voted in, doesn't the necessity of governance and the compromises they have to make in order to govern moderate them anyway?
On this question of the United States only liking the people that gets elected, and you mentioned the issue of Egypt, and since I'm writing a book about Egypt, I feel compelled to respond. There's not a single Egyptian official, nor is there a single American government official who believes that the United States is no longer pressuring the Egyptians on democratic reform. It's just not true. In fact, I was in Cairo in September, and at the same time that the United States government presented papers to the Egyptian government that included benchmarks for democratic change, and that is even with 88 members of the Muslim Brotherhood in the Egyptian parliament. The difference between the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas is that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt has not engaged in an act of violence since at least the 1970s. You can't say the same thing about Hamas. Well, that's terrific.
Well, that's because
Stanley Cohen.
There's been a million people that belong to the Muslim Brotherhood and probably 200,000 in Egypt that are in jail because as soon as the Muslim Brotherhood tries to run for election, they get jailed.
They won.
They get tortured. They get no. They didn't.
88 members won. Come on.
Who's controlling Egypt right now? The Brotherhood?
We clearly know who's controlling Egypt.
The question asked is: do we support democracies that we like, and do we oppose democracies that we don't? And the reality of it is, when Musharraf became...
You have absolutely no understanding of what the U.S. government is doing right now to promote democracy in the Middle East.
Ask the audience. They see it every night on television, what the United States is doing to promote democracy. If you're with us, you're okay. If you're not, you're a good Muslim or you're a bad Muslim, Mr. Bush. It doesn't change, no matter what you want to call it.
Who's going to be the next president of Egypt? You think he's going to be democratically elected, or is he going to be the son of Mubarak?
Or Jordan, that other bastion of support, progressive ideology that the Israeli ambassador supports. You're good if you're with us, and if you're not, you're not. And it really doesn't matter. If you follow our politics, you're a good guy, and if you don't, you're traif. How's that, expert in Egypt?
Well, I think this is...
Daniel Ayalon.
I think that this is really nonsense. I think we are here talking, you know, in just slogans, democracy. First of all, we have to remember, you know, elections. Democracy doesn't start with elections. It doesn't end with elections. There is a culture There should be a rule of law. There should be a participation of all walks of life in a society. Unfortunately, we have a backward situation in all the Muslim and Arab countries where there is no middle class. There is only elite who really control all the resources, all the political power, all the economics and everything else, and all the others are poor, uneducated, and really they are subject to the incitement of the ideological zealots from Iran.
What an arrogant statement to talk about a 5,000-year-old culture.
I'm sorry, I'm talking about facts. I'm just talking about facts. So what I would answer to you is, no, we should not promote democracy in the Middle East. What we should promote is equal opportunities. What we should promote is empowerment of women. What we should promote is good education for the people, so there's not these inequalities. And when the people themselves will have a stake in their own lives, in their societies, they will decide what type of regime they do want.
Mike Perry.
What the ambassador means to say is there won't be a vote until the people are ready, which is just exactly what J. Edgar Hoover said about African Americans in America 30 years ago.
This has nothing to do with that, and irrelevant.
Just a quick comment on this, with all due respect to the ambassador.
Mahmoud Mohamedou. Yes,
this is precisely what I meant by unilateral understanding. We hear it here again. We have to decide this. We have to support. It's very, very paternalistic. It's as if all of these populations have no sense of what is important to them, what is legitimate for them, who stands for them. I mean, Fatah has lost all credibility in that area, not simply because of external support, essentially for what they've done. The people know who stands for them. People know who will defend them. And if Hamas has left that scene, which was, as I said, a military scene, has chosen to represent a democratic in a democratic way these groups, then it's something that speaks for the values of these people. And keep in mind as well who was fielded.
The second question from the audience concerned Hamas's refusal to recognize Israel. It prompted this exchange between Stanley Cohen, whom we'll hear first, and Ambassador Daniel Ayalon.
If Hamas refuses to recognize Israel, how can the organization support a two-state solution?
Well, governments say things all the time. If Hamas tomorrow said, we recognize the state of Israel, the right of Israel to exist, the ambassador would say, prove it. Come back to us in 20 years. When you've shown, we'll accept it for 20 years. The reality of it is, I'm not concerned about what people say they will do. I'm more concerned about what, in fact, they do and on the ground. The reality of it is that you've got statements that have come as close as are going to come, that talk about if we go back to the 67 borders, that is the starting point, and that's where we're going to move. Don't get hung up on the rhetoric of labels. Don't get hung up on, we recognize your right to exist. What about recognizing the right of return? Stanley Cohen can go home, but if my name is Mahmoud, I can't go home. So you have to be reciprocal. I haven't heard a word from Israel about the right of return. I haven't heard a word from Israel about the right to a government. I haven't heard a word from Israel about the right to recognize what the Palestinian people want.
You'll hear it pretty soon.
You want unilateral concessions.
Can I answer to that? Well, don't judge us and don't tell me what Israel will say for 20 more years. Just judge us by our deeds. When Egypt was ready to recognize Israel, we signed a peace treaty. The same with Jordan. The same with the PLO. And I take issue. I think it's incorrect what you mentioned here. Israel was ready to recognize the PLO and talk to them only after Yitzhak Rabin, late Yitzhak Rabin, received a letter signed by Yasser Arafat, 9th of September, 1993, which renounced terror, which recognized Israel's right to exist, and which also promised to change this charter that you're talking about. This is exactly what we are expecting from Hamas. And this is not just an Israeli expectation. This is a demand by the entire international community, as was expressed by the quartet, the four parties that are responsible for the peace process in the Middle East. If you renounce terror, if you recognize Israel's right to exist and you abolish your charter, and now also if you accept all previous agreements which were signed by the PLO, then you are a legitimate partner. But they're not doing that because they are still a terror organization, because they do not believe in coexistence, and they do believe not in building a nation, but destroying one, which is ours. And we are not going to let them do that. You're talking about Stanley Cohen, about the right of return. What kind of right of return? There's no right of return. There were Arabs there, which we wanted to coexist with them, but they were killing Jews.
It's all a conspiracy from Iran and Syria. 800,000 people just woke up and moved.
Just read history. Just read the history, and then you will know. There is not such a thing as right of return. There is a problem of the refugees. This is true. There is a refugee problem, but the responsibility for the refugee problems lie on the heads of the leaders of the Palestinians and of the Arabs.
Wow. Wow. Unbelievable.
To conclude, we'll hear excerpts, one from each side, of the debate's closing arguments. Speaking first against the motion, a democratically elected Hamas is still a terrorist organization, here is Mahmoud Mohamedou.
Apparently winning it. And it's a pity because the whole debate was not necessarily about this pro-Israeli or pro-Arab or pro-Palestinian. It's really something different. It was about justice. People fighting a justice are not terrorists. It's about international legality. Wars of national liberation are not terrorism. And it's about the cogency of our moral principles. And although one might think that there's something inevitable about the Arab-Israeli conflict, I, for one, would like to believe that it's not. Imagine if the EU were to call a Hamas delegation and have an adult conversation with them. Imagine if the Secretary of State were to address elected officials and invite them and discuss with them. Imagine if the Israeli population elected a government from which they asked an end to inhumane policies and negotiations with whomever is in charge. This, I think, would quell the violence on both sides, resuscitate the peace talks, and get us into a new dynamic. You don't have to imagine the other opposite situations. We're in it, and we'll continue to be in it as long as motions such as tonight will continue to be vetted. Thank you.
For the motion, John O'Sullivan.
The argument that we should be having, as well as the particular argument about the Middle East, is an argument about violence in politics. When violence enters politics, it's very hard to drive it out again. And when indiscriminate violence against innocent people enters, it damages a society very strongly indeed. Now, that's not the only way to have a revolution. Polish solidarity won independence from Russia. And that has been repeated in Georgia and in the Ukraine and elsewhere by a campaign of moral resistance and cultural resistance that wore down the opposition and persuaded people to come over to it. That's the kind of revolution, if one is needed, that's the kind of revolutionary course that we should encourage people to pursue. We should not turn a blind eye to their crimes because they have managed to be elected. It's a fine thing to be elected, but it doesn't absolve you from the laws of human conduct that the rest of us are supposed to obey.
And that concludes our debate. The audience was polled a second time at the end of the evening on the resolution, a democratically elected Hamas is still a terrorist organization, and once again the audience approved the motion, 51% voting in favor and only 32% opposing, 17% didn't know. It must be noted that while the pros carried the day, the cons narrowed the margin of victory. Votes in favor of the proposition went down by 9 percentage points between the two polls, while votes against the motion increased by 13 percentage points. You can hear this program and other debates in the Intelligence Squared series at npr.org/intelligencesquared. The Intelligence Squared U.S. debate series is an initiative of the Rosenkranz Foundation, Chairman Robert Rosenkranz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series, or to find out how you can get tickets to attend a future live event, visit www.iq2us.org. That's www.iq2us.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. This series is produced for radio by WNYC New York Public Radio. Producer Rob Christensen, senior producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Edward Haber and Damon Whittemore. Intelligence Squared US is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.